It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Welcome to another BritFlix podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is producer, writer, director, Travis Stevens. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm very well. Now, we're here to do two things. We're here to talk about your new movie, A Wounded Fawn, and we're also here to pick the bones out of three films that impacted everything in your adult life. Now, we'll do that second. But before we do, just to get the format, so people who've not been familiar with how I might do this, Travis has given me three titles, which he's going to talk about with me. And every time we hear this sound will be the time to stop talking about that film and move on to the next one. So you can hear that alarm at your end, Travis?
I sure can.
Good man. So that just brings a little bit of jeopardy to the show. It also makes me a passive-aggressive host because I don't tell you to shut up. The iPhone does.
I love it.
But before we do, let's talk about A Wounded Fawn. So first off, when and how can people see it?
A Wounded Fawn is available on Shudder starting December 1st. I'm not sure when this will air, but in theory, it's on Shudder by the time your listeners are hearing this. And then I believe 6 months later, it'll be on the other platforms. But what you want to do is you want to watch it on Shudder, because not only can you watch Wounded Fawn on Shudder, you'll be able to watch Blood Relatives on Shudder, which is Noah Segan's amazing Jewish daddy vampire flick. You can watch Christmas Bloody Christmas on Shudder, which is Joe Bagos' killer Santa robot movie. If you like Wounded Fawn, you can go into their huge library or catalog of giallo films. Like, Shudder is basically the best party in the world for horror films. So I encourage everybody to watch it on Shudder. If you don't have Shudder, if you have somebody in your life who's thinking about buying you a Christmas gift, you know, maybe give them a little encouragement to check out Shudder, a subscription to Shudder, because that makes a great gift. So yeah, that's basically it, man. Like, I really love them, and hopefully people listening to the podcast have the service.
Okay, well, look, well, I'll make sure there's a link in the show notes to Shudder. That's not a problem. I can do that part. So let's talk about A Wounded Fawn. So where does that film start for you? I see there's two writing credits, Nathan Fordry and yourself. So are you writing that together, or is that a film that Nathan had started and you got involved with?
Yeah, Nathan had written a script called The Furies that was sent to me that had the basic story of a killer and a girl go to a cabin and the Furies show up. Great concept, great premise. I hadn't been aware of the Furies as sort of a literary, I hadn't been aware of the myth. And so, you know, because I had made a couple movies about guys learning lessons, I had to find a sort of new way into this. And so I think my work on that script sort of said, well, what is a new setting I can put into this world? What are some themes I can bring into this world? What are some visuals I can bring into this world? And how can I contemporize the Furies in a narrative that feels relevant to 2022. And that sort of started the whole process of reworking reworking it. But Nathan did a great job coming up with the original script.
One of the things that will strike people when they do get to see it, because I don't want to get into any spoiler territory, so I'll focus on certain aspects of the aesthetic of your film, is the use of surreal art, and in particular, surreal art done by female artists. So how was that drawn into a story?
Well, I think in part of my trying to figure out how to sort of make another movie that had similar themes, I was like, you know, what can I do differently about it? Mm. And the idea of symbolism being more sort of exaggerated in the cinematic language, sort of leaning heavily into the aesthetics and really getting inside the characters' heads and how they were experiencing the world, that seemed to be a fresh way into the basic story. And then once I had that as an idea, then sort of exploring surrealist art, exploring sort of the creative process associated with creating surrealist art, opened up a whole new sort of approach for me. And as I've said in other interviews, I felt there was a parallel between sort of the power that a serial killer takes from his victims and what had happened to a bunch of sort of the female surrealist painters as their work got overshadowed by the male artists. Yeah. Sometimes they were their partners, sometimes they were, you know, the quote unquote muse, and their own sort of agency and their own sort of value got drained a bit, as you know, because it was just a different time. So that was the working thesis.
And Sarah Lynn's character is the central character of Meredith.
Yeah.
She is the almost like the classic, although we don't know it until we get into the story, of the kind of once bitten, twice shy in terms of abusive male relationships. I mean, obviously this is the extreme end of it, where he's potentially someone who might kill her, as opposed to someone who's just violent, for not to make slight of it. What were the challenges there for sort of with directing that role? You know, sort of, because there's obviously what she brings to that role as a woman, and you as the director of the film. How do you balance the sort of needs and wants of your film and the actor in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, well, on one level, you know, I was very fortunate to be incredibly collaborative with Sarah. We have a creative and romantic relationship. So we had a much longer time together on the project than you're normally or typically allowed when you're making a low budget feature. Yeah. So that definitely, you know, her perspective informed the story throughout the rewrites and all of that. But on another level, you know, I think for me, in looking at this story, I think typically when we are putting a woman in jeopardy, there is a certain narrative arc that follows. And it was important to me to not follow that typical arc. And so by starting Meredith's character basically at the end of that typical narrative arc, she's already learned all of the lessons she needs to learn. So this movie is about the next chapter. And I think that changes what that character's arc looks like, because they're not coming into the world naive, then discovering it's dangerous, and then, you know, learning a lesson. She's already learned the lesson, and the movie is about testing whether or not she's going to enact what she's learned. And I think that was a bit different both for the film and for the actor to work with, because it's a much shorter or tighter radius. So I think that was something that was interesting. I think what I liked about that is because Josh, who plays Bruce in the movie, his character and his performance is more exaggerated, because he's still thinking he's the star of the show, and he's you know, like the ringmaster. He's a very sort of thinks highly of himself, very pompous sort of character. So he's a bit more clownish and exaggerated. Meredith being more grounded and Sarah playing her is a much more subtle performance. So the two of those together as a filmmaker was really interesting to sort of balance and tinker with.
Yeah, yeah. Because in a way, and I don't even just thought of this as you were talking there, it's like the Bruce character makes almost like what we see in Wounded Form, almost like how to deconstruct a man, like this person that thinks he knows what it is to be in charge, to like you say, be the ringmaster and find that maybe all the cards haven't been dealt to him.
Yeah, I mean, the story is about popping the balloon. Mm. And the balloon in this case is his sense of self, the way he defines himself, the way he presents himself to the world and the way he presents himself to himself. Mm. And the story is about sort of saying, hey, that's an illusion. You've got to acknowledge reality. I think that was something that in the sort of rewrite of the script and in the filmmaking and working with the actors, that was, you know, probably the meat of what we were doing. Mm. And, you know, there's tons of wild visuals and tons of sort of like aggressively experimental cinema happening at the same time.
Yeah.
But dramatically, the core of the story is that.
Yeah, I must admit, I think that was the thing that really grabbed me after I finished watching it, is that for much of the film, I felt like I was lost in the weeds of what was going on because of the experimentation that I'm being asked to experience. But actually, you were dripping us narrative, although I wasn't sure at the time that I was getting narrative. And then I come out of it with a resolution. I'm like, Jesus. And it's a bit kind of like you're gasping for breath when the film concludes what it's just took you through.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You know, I don't know if this is your experience or your listeners' experiences, but when you consume a lot of movies, you know, it'd be like being a food critic, and it's like you're looking for a meal that is different. It needs to work. It needs to, the flavors need to work together, but you're just craving something that is a bit unusual or something new. Mm. And I think for me in making the films, I'm trying to sort of deconstruct the way structure works a little bit, the way themes relate to structure. You know, I'm just trying to change things up a little bit. And what I hope is at the end of the movie, it sits with you a while. And as you sort of, you know, an hour later, a day later, or a month later, aspects of that meal, you remember in a different way. And you're sort of like, oh, you know, versus while you're sitting there eating the meal, you're like, yep, that's what a steak tastes like. Yep, that's what a potato tastes like. Yep, there's some broccoli. Ah, I ate steak, potatoes, and broccoli. And then you walk away and you don't ever think about the meal again.
It's interesting you use the food metaphor. There's a great interview with James Gray where he talks about the fact that we're going to lose the art of storytelling because we keep feeding people hamburgers, he says, because then when you present them with sushi, they go, what the fuck's that?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Not to be all like the savior of cinema.
No.
I'm just a guy making my way through this shit. But,
of course.
You know.
But the thing is, it's from an audience, if I can reflect back then in the audience perspective, then for me was, I'm thinking while I'm watching this film is cleverer than me, or the action is one step ahead of me, so I can't predict it. Interestingly, I had the same experience with Merlin Barr's, the film she was in, Honeydew. I've seen that film 100 times where people end up in some farmhouse, but I didn't see where it was. When it started to go on its left turn, I'm like, I don't know where it's going now. And then when it finishes, much like when your film finished, I felt smarter for the journey, which is there where the thoughts start going, because that's after the fact. It's like, I'm like, what have I learned? I don't know yet, but I'll work that out.
Yeah. I mean, I guess with all art, you're going to get some of the experiences based on what's happening in real time when you're seeing it or experiencing it.
Yeah.
And then There's what happens once you walk away from the painting, or once you leave the concert venue, or what once you leave the movie theater. And hopefully what's happened in that art is sticking with you, and you're thinking about it and circling back on it, and maybe even revisiting it in the future and being like, let me take a look at it with a different set of eyes now that I've already seen it once. You know?
Now, Travis, that couldn't have been a better segue if I'd scripted it really about what we're going to talk about next. Because what we are going to talk about is that the idea that the film can have an impact on you. So we're going to take the audience through now your three films that impacted everything in your adult life. And we're going to start in 1974, and I'll just get the clock running so we know we're going to get 5 minutes. So the clock's running on 1974's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Important differentiation between all of the Chainsaw Massacres is there's a space between chain and saw, for starters, which is always the thing I enjoy every time I see the title. But tell us where does the film live for you? Where do you first see it? What impact does it have on you?
All right. Well, so first, I need to just say up front that my brain does not retain facts or details. What I can tell you about is my sort of emotional, expressionistic emotional memory of things. So, you know, like when I listen to Quentin Tarantino and Roger Avery's podcast, like Quentin's able to be, yes, I saw that in 1978 at this movie theater. I still have the ticket. And I'm just like, holy shit, that is a completely different way to experience films. And I don't have that. So if I get any details wrong on any of these films, please forgive me. Go to Wikipedia if you want facts. But what I will share is my own truth.
No, and that's the truth we're looking for here, because it's the impact on your life.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't remember exactly when I first saw the film.
Yeah.
And I think I would assume it would have been in the early 80s on VHS at a friend's house. Because my family, we didn't have a VCR for the, I'd say the first 5 years that they existed. So when we wanted to rent a movie, it's like on my birthday, my family would go down to the video store and rent the VCR, and we could get three movies. And those movies were never allowed to be horror movies or R-rated or anything. So I'd have to go to friends' houses who had parents who maybe had looser morals. and that's where I saw a lot of the sort of definitive horror films. But so I don't remember exactly when I first saw it, but I think it was around the time, you know, I'd seen, you know, the Friday the 13th and, some of the other sort of classics, but there's something about Texas Chainsaw that stands out. And it's like some of those movies, you feel safe while you're watching because you're outside the story. And there's something about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre where I didn't feel safe when I watched it. Like it felt real. And maybe for the first half of my life since seeing it, I thought that was because of the story or, you know, because it's presented as based on, you know, a true story. But now I've come to realize like that is just the filmmaking. Like the filmmaking itself creates such a detailed environment. Like the vibe of the film is so complete and so surrounds those characters. And from shot to shot and beat to beat, you don't see the edge of the stage that story is taking place on. You're fully surrounded by it. And it just blows my mind. Like every single time I watch that movie, I get a different experience from it.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Get all the Masterforce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with Masterforce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with Masterforce power equipment at Menards. Save big money at
Menards. And, you know, as an adult now watching it in as a filmmaker, it's a miracle that on that shooting schedule and with that crew size, they were able to create image after image that is so aesthetically sophisticated.
Yeah.
And so effective. So, I mean, obviously people have been talking about, you know, it's a masterpiece, and it, you know, I'm not going to add anything to that. Like other people, smarter people can say it, but I can just say from my own experience, I think that's the horror movie that there's so many like facets to it that every time you look at it, you can see something different in it.
Mm. I mean, it's the proto Final Girl as a thing, right. You know, Carolyn Glover's essay, Men, Women and Chainsaws in 92, you know, she cites that as the start of that phenomena. You don't see a chainsaw, just to give you some facts, you don't see a chainsaw until 55 minutes in. So film with such an amazing title. I mean, it's like, what more do you need with that title? But then the layers of the story, which, you know, is this about the rural taking revenge on the city? Like, I mean, again, part of Carolyn Glover's, Urbanoia, this idea. But then it's like hippies just being carefree, you know, and somehow not respecting tradition. You know, was it just as simple as that? Oh, there's our bell.
Oh, well, let me just say one last thing.
Go on, please. Yeah, no, you're all right. It's not the law.
Okay, good. Because we'll be punk rock about it. We'll be like, I think too, at least when I was younger, like at this point in time, when people first see the film, the imagery is probably, they've probably already seen the imagery on the internet. You know, in some way it's come across them. But when I first saw it, the poster itself, the mask itself, the presentation of Leatherface was so grotesque and so absolutely terrifying as a concept of like, this person's wearing someone else's skin as a mask. Like, you couldn't wrap your head around that because you'd never seen or even thought of anything like that before. And in this movie, like, sure, that comes in later, but you start in this bright, colorful, idealistic, sort of safe feeling world, and you go into that house with Sun, and you're like, I'm with the, you know, this great, good looking, fun group of friends, and you get punched in the face, you get hit over the head with the hammer just like the character. And back in the day, like before that sort of iconography was so well established, I mean, it fucking blew my mind. It was terrifying. And the execution now, you can still watch it, and it's still terrifying. But back then, without having seen that sort of imagery before, I mean, it was just, it's mind blowing.
Well, you know, when you were watching it, obviously, I'm like the same generation as you. It was banned in the UK. So when I first watch it, I see it on a 8th generation pirate copy. So I'm seeing the grainiest of grainy versions of this illicit film, really. So it was so heightened to watch it the first time for me. And then fast forward to the 21st century, Fright Fest show it with Toby Hooper doing a Q&A. And suddenly I'm watching it on a 60-foot screen at the Empire Leicester Square. And it's like that when that frame of the flicker of the blinking eye of Sally is the whole 60-foot screen. It's like I've landed in cinema utopia. You know, it's like it's.
Yeah. I mean, that movie is, the shots in that movie are art. Like they're like frame after frame is like pure aesthetic fucking masterworks. Like, it's not just shoot it and get the information to tell what's happening. Mm. It's like, it is invoking an emotion. And I think, you know, it even actually influenced a little bit of the Wounded Fawn. Like, that opening is so goddamn experimental. Mm. And automatically puts you in a certain emotional state. And I think I hadn't ever realized that before, that like, this motherfucker spent the time to figure out, how do I create that emotion before I even introduce the story?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, well, that's what a master does. I should aim for that.
Well, look, let's jump 2 years to an Oscar-winning movie, Rocky. Where does that fit in your cinematic canon of life?
So I probably saw Rocky III or Rocky IV first.
Okay.
But around the same era, you know, like Rocky, like it was just culturally in the States, this was, you know, our new sort of Santa Claus. You know, it was just a cultural symbol that everybody understood or had a shorthand with or thought they understood. And I think I don't remember exactly when I first saw the original Rocky, but certainly as an adult, and when I show it to other people or talk to people about it, what that movie is it's remarkable how different it is from that sort of cultural icon that at least in the 80s, we thought of as Rocky. Like, when I tell people, no, it's not really a boxing movie, it's a romance. Like, what are you talking about? I know what Rocky is. And I'm like, no, you gotta believe me. And, you know, the craftsmanship in that movie for what I believe was like a dollar budget, you know, basically an independent film. I know UA like financed it, but they didn't really want to. That story, I think what I take away from it as a filmmaker is, if your movie feels authentic, you can create huge, exaggerated, iconic moments. And that figuring out that math of how you get to those big, huge movie moments from a place of reality is something that I find fascinating. Mm. Like, I mean, there is from the locations they shot in, the music choices they use, the use of the Steadicam, like for a $1 million movie, in again, sort of like Texas Chainsaw, in scene after scene after scene, the choices being made are so smart and so effective. And I just think that performance of everybody is sincere. You feel that romance. You feel that yearning for a bigger, better life. You feel that sort of doubt that he has about himself. And that speech where he sort of says, and that's okay. I mean, as an adult male, you know, you're like, that really touches. Mm. You know, where you're just sort of like, I'm going to do the best I can. And that's okay. Like, I don't need to necessarily win. I mean, that's pretty fucking Buddhist.
Yeah.
Good on Stallone for reaching that sort of a breakthrough at such an early age.
But also interestingly, for what is like you say is a romance story, it's also gritty realism of blue collar life in America in mid to late 70s, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of. It's not pretty. Yeah. Nobody's living their best life. They're just surviving. And obviously a boxer is a very good metaphor for surviving.
Yeah. But I think, again, I use the word authentic, but I feel like the boxing gym they chose, the streets they chose to have the characters walk down, the, singers on the street corner, the sharing of the wine bottle, what his life as a small-time enforcer looks like, who he's trying to shake down to get their payments, how, like all of that, the jackets, all of these things, that world feels so fully realized that then you buy into this sort of bigger myth story that that happens. And it's like, you know, I think Irvin Winkler like gives all the credit to Sly. He's like, that he is the one who knew all of the details. And again, as at this point in life, thinking about that, the fact that Sylvester Stallone wrote that story, believed in himself so much, found people to believe in him, and that was the end result of his first movie. It's like, it's incredible. Like, I'm in absolute awe of him as an artist, and I'm in absolute awe of every single person and their contributions to that movie, because I think it's one of the greatest movies ever made. Look at that. Now, right on the bell.
Right on the button, man. Punch in. That was amazing. you maybe be sad to learn then that that Rocky is now currently being used by bookmakers in the UK for their TV advertising campaign, where they've used CGI to have a load of people running behind him in the iconic. But it's interesting you say about how iconic it was in terms of it's Rocky being this kind of reflection of America at the time, and obviously it became much more sort of Star Spangled Banner as it went through the franchise, but the original one was more grounded. In Britain, we watched Rocky II first. I remember that as a kid. We watched Rocky II, and then it was like you went back to Rocky, but it was that phenomena even in the UK, even though we're not, you know, America's thousands and thousands of miles away, and it was then as well. But it was it was definitely an event for us as well. And I went to see Rocky IV on a first date. That was where Rocky fits in my youth. A young woman called Paula. We went and watched it.
How'd the date go? Was she filled with American patriotism? And you guys went and got a cheeseburger afterwards and made out, or what?
Well, we didn't get married in the end. There was no love story in the end of that one. But it was nice. It was nice to go. It was like my first proper date. You know, like going out to going out with a girl to the cinema. It's like, you know, it was just that kind of that part of me life. You know. Well, look, let's jump. We're going to jump 13 years now to 1989 to a very different movie to the other two. The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and a Lover.
Yeah, I mean, I probably saw this in college.
Okay.
And I think I was consuming cinema in a very passive way through college. I mean, up until college, probably through most of my fucking life after college too, where you're just sort of watching stuff. You're not really thinking about how it works, how what you're seeing works. And I think The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover was the first movie where, because the way the story was being told was so exaggerated, I was forced to be like, okay, what's happening here? Noticing the costume changes as you pass from one room to the next, lighting changes, and being like, well, this feels different. And I maybe this isn't true, but I feel like it was the first time I understood, like, wait, there are decisions being made in how to tell the story that is evoking different emotions, which is terrifying to have, you know, in college where you're studying film. Hopefully you would learn that earlier in the process, maybe even before you decided to make movies, that you would come to the understanding, like, the choices I make while making this is going to elicit reaction. But that was such an exaggerated form of storytelling that it just sort of, it's like I was on a movie set and I was looking towards the set. And then suddenly that movie said, hey, turn around. And I looked around and saw, oh, this is how a movie's made. Like, it was completely opened up my whole perspectives. And I mean, I think it's a fucking another masterpiece, but the aesthetics, the control, the how the score is utilized, how the costumes is utilized, how the acting is sort of amped up to a level that fits on that stage. It's just It is a movie that's all garnish. It's all of the stuff that normally, you know, would be toned down. And it just sort of lives in it.
Was this a film presented to you as part of film school? Or was this a film you discovered through school?
No, I think this would have been like going through the video store and just looking for stuff.
Okay.
You know, on the weekends. And so back in this age, you could get like 10 movies for $10, but you had to bring them back in 2 days.
Yeah.
So, you know, you just get a big stack. So you're that's almost its own film school where you're just chewing through as much as you can fit in a small amount of time. And, you know, I probably just picked it up because I was like, oh, look at that cover. You know, that looks sexy.
Yeah.
But, you know.
So wouldn't have even been the name of Peter Greenaway. It was just literally.
No. And then I was like, okay, well, who is this cat? And I think, what was it? Eight Women. Is that the other title?
Yeah,
Drowning by Pillows or Drowning by Numbers and the Pillow Book. I didn't feel the same way about those movies. They were maybe just a little more intellectual than I was ready for, but yeah. The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and the Lover, that storyline that, and just sort of anchors all of that sort of artistry in a way that was a lot more digestible for me.
So when you say before that before this film, you were kind of watching films in it was a passive experience watching movies. So do you mean in the sense of it was entertain me and then I'll tell you if I'm entertained, and then suddenly you watch the film where it's not even inviting that question?
Yeah. It's, I don't know how much I was thinking about the movie. So yeah, it was just sort of consuming.
Yeah.
You know, and when you see something that's just like, stop, look at this.
Mm.
And it forces you for a very long time. Like that opening shot in that movie, you know, and that opening sequence is like, by the time it finishes, you are in a different place than when you put that movie in the VCR.
Your experience of it is calls back to what I said before about James Gray. It was like, this film was your sushi after eating a load of hamburgers.
Yeah, exactly. It's very fitting for that to be the movie too. And I think too, you know, now as an adult, you know, the sexuality and the just sort of like comfortability, the comfort with sort of like, this is a story about adults and adult relationships with adult passions, expressing that. And we're going to show it. We're not going to hide it. We're not going to hint at it. We're not going to exaggerate it in the way that Hollywood, you know, Top Gun or Tony Scott or Ridley Scott would show, you know, a sex scene. It was also just sort of mind blowing to me and something that, you know, I still crave in cinema now.
Well, look, that's your three movies, the three films that impacted everything in adult life. That was Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Rocky, The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover. A Wounded Fawn is on Shudder from the 1st of December. The link will be in the show notes. And it just gives me to say thank you very much for joining us on the Britflix podcast to talk about your films.
Hey, Stuart, I love chatting movies with you. So anytime.
Another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.